Never apologize for being smart. I didn't see much of Miss Chevalier. She didn't have a lot to do with the Saturday Club anymore, and neither did I. Gussie was still a gung-ho member, but after Irene got married, I sort of lost interest. So when I ran into Miss Chevalier on the street after work, it was like seeing a rainbow. Except for a little gray in her hair and a few lines on her face, she hadn't changed much in 10 years. She was still wearing the same sensible tie-up shoes, and her smile still made me feel like I'd won a prize. I asked about the library and Miss Green. She asked about my family and how I liked my job. I don't know why, but instead of saying what you're supposed to say, which is, "It's fine," I went off about how the men in the office treated me like I was a servant, and that I hated writing about how Mrs. Porridge served pink petit fours in honor of Mrs. Pudding, or who won the Dahlia competition. I said, "I'm glad my name isn't on that damn column." It just spilled out of me. Miss Chevalier said, "Oh, dear." I was still writing Seen and Heard, but with strict orders to stay away from Cambridge and anything controversial. I also had to stick to the top of the social register and talk only to hostesses or chair ladies, which meant that every program was enlightening and every speaker distinguished. There were lots of times I wanted to change distinguished to over the hill, but I didn't want to lose my job. It wasn't perfect, but in a newsroom, at least you're never bored, what with the crackpots on the telephone, the reporters' tantrums, and the excitement when a story comes in late and the whole section has to be changed at the last minute. But why was I kvetching to the woman who was my, what should I call her? My mentor? My guardian angel? I said I was sorry. "Never apologize for being smart," Miss Chevalier said. "Why don't you come to my house on Sunday afternoon? I'm hosting a few friends, and I promise there won't be any petty fours. I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation." I went, of course. I was curious to see where she lived, and I wanted to say hello to Miss Green. Even though we had never had much to do with each other, she was the only person I knew who cared as much about Philomena as I did. I was missing Philomena a lot. She sent me a postcard every month, so I knew she was thinking of me, but it wasn't much comfort when I was feeling blue. The Ediths were now living in an old brownstone in the South End, the kind where you go up a flight of stairs to get to the front door, and all the rooms have high ceilings and tall windows. It was on one of those wonderful blocks with a strip of grass and trees in the middle of the street. There was an elegant marble fireplace in the living room, but the paint was peeling on the woodwork, and the rug was a little threadbare. Shabby genteel, if you know what I mean. There were no tea cakes or even tea, just as Miss Chevalier promised. She served sandwiches and coffee, which seemed much more modern to me. I was sorry that Miss Green was under the weather and didn't come downstairs, but when I saw her paintings on the walls, in my mind I started writing a letter to tell Philomena about how her teacher's purple skies and yellow hills reminded me of the tinted postcards she sent from New Mexico. I could imagine Philomena reading that and smiling. Miss Chevalier introduced me to her friends, and what an impressive bunch. I met the president of the Women's Educational and Industrial Union, the director of the Boston School Lunch Program, a history professor from Wellesley College, and a lady doctor with a thick German accent. The room was buzzing with conversations about politics and books. I didn't hear a single word about dahlias or summering in Manchester. I remember thinking how nice it was that these old ladies had such good friends. Ha! Those old ladies were probably in their 50s. Being 85 gives you perspective. It also gives you arthritis. Maybe you should stitch these pearls of wisdom on a sampler. Do you even know what a sampler is? Not everyone was old. There were a few girls like me in their 20s, and they were interesting, too. A social worker for the city health department, a librarian from East Boston, a nurse, and a law student. When I found out that Rita Metzke, the law student, was going to Portia Law School, I said I knew someone who had graduated from there. Do you know Gussie Frommer? She smiled. Everybody knows Gussie. We traded stories about my outgoing friend, but Rita kept looking at the clock on the mantel and frowning. My brother is supposed to give a talk, and he should have been here by now. I told him I'd kill him if he kept these women waiting. When he did arrive, out of breath and carrying a suitcase, he said the train from Washington was late, apologized like he had nearly missed his own wedding. Miss Chevalier told him to take a minute, have a cup of coffee. He winked at Rita. My sister would tell you I don't deserve it. You couldn't miss the resemblance between Rita and Aaron Metzke. They were both about 4 inches taller than me, with dark brown eyes, thick, almost black hair, and thin, straight noses, except that his was a little bit flattened on the end, like a hawk, but handsome. He was a lawyer for the National Child Labor Committee, and he'd been traveling around the country trying to pass the amendment against child labor. Aaron Metzke wasn't there to convince Miss Chevalier's friends about the need. Those women supported everything they thought would help poor people, and keeping girls out of factories and sweatshops was one of their regular causes. He was there to report about how the campaign was going, but the news wasn't good. He had just gotten back from 2 weeks in the South, where states had been voting the amendment down one after another. They saw it as a plot by Northerners to keep them poor and weak. He said they're still fighting the Civil War down there. But even in the North, farmers, the Catholic Church, and even the anti-prohibition people were all siding with the mill owners. They kept saying that the law was a communist plot to take children away from their parents. Aaron shook his head. When people find out where I come from, they say, if Massachusetts voted this down, what makes you think it's going to happen in Alabama or Mississippi? To tell you the truth, I don't have a good answer for them. The young social worker behind me jumped up and shook her finger at him. I'll give you your answer. Bert Forster, a 14-year-old boy who lost all the fingers on his right hand from working in the Connecticut tobacco fields. Or Selma Trudeau over at the Florence Crittenden home, who had a baby at 15 because some man promised to marry her and take her away from the Lawrence Mills. The German doctor said that child labor could cause great harm later in life, too. Deafness from loud machines, lung diseases from cotton dust, and nervous exhaustion that could lead to insanity and even suicide. They were talking about my sisters. Betty was probably 12 when she came to America. Celia was maybe 10. And they went to work right off the boat. They got jobs wherever Papa went, which meant they worked in a candy factory and a shoe factory. When he became a presser, they learned how to use a sewing machine and worked in one sweatshop after another. Levine's was better than most because there was a bathroom and he didn't lock them in all day, but I remember how unbearable it was in the summer. I wondered, did working as a little girl kill whatever strength Celia had been born with? Betty was made of stronger stuff, but she got away from factory work soon as she could, and I knew she'd sooner cut off her arm than let any of her children work like she had. Betty and Levine wouldn't even let Jake sell newspapers after school. "Let him play with a ball," Betty said. "Let him be a little boy." It was different by the time I was born. Pretty much all the children in my neighborhood went to school at least until they were 13 or 14, and a lot graduated from high school. Some of the bigger boys sold newspapers, and I'm sure lots of little kids worked nights and weekends making paper flowers or sewing piecework at home, but it wasn't as bad as factory work. The discussion around me heated up. Miss Chevalier was standing up, pounding her fist on the palm of her hand. "The arguments against this law are outrageous. You hear things like, a mother could be arrested for asking her 17-year-old daughter to wash the dishes. How in God's name is protecting the young anything but just?" Aaron didn't seem to be listening. He was staring at Rita, who was sitting next to me. She poked me in the ribs and whispered, "My brother can't keep his eyes off you." I looked again and realized that she was right. He was looking at me. When he saw that I was looking back, he smiled. Then I smiled. How could I not? He was smart. He had a nice way with words. He was Jewish. And he was good looking. Aaron seemed so perfect. I giggled. But then I remembered what rotten luck I'd had with men and went to get myself another cup of coffee. After Aaron finished his speech, everyone rushed up to him with questions and advice. I waited for a while to see if he would come talk to me, but I lost my nerve and left. I was halfway down the block and sorry I hadn't been a little more patient or brave when I heard someone call my name. Aaron was running with his suitcase in one hand, his coat in the other, and a dopey smile on his face. "It's Addie, right? Rita didn't get your last name. I'm Aaron Metzke, her brother." I said, "It's Baum." "What is?" "My name." "Baum," he said. I laughed. He laughed. Then he asked if he could take me to supper, but only if I was hungry, or maybe I was already busy, or was someone waiting for me, a fiancé, or did I think it was too early to eat? Did I know what time it was? He was adorable. But he kept on talking and talking. So I put out my hand and I said, "Nice to meet you." His hand was warm, and he didn't let go of mine. We stood there grinning at each other like we'd hit the jackpot. Finally, I said, "Where do you want to eat?" He asked if I liked Chinese food. I said I'd give it a try. "Did you know there was a time before all Jews loved Chinese food?" It was quite a long walk to the restaurant, but it went by in a flash. I had never had a conversation like that with a man. Not that it was profound or personal, it was just easy. We went from one topic to another. We interrupted each other and we laughed. Aaron used to tell people he fell in love with me at first sight, which sounded ridiculous the first 100 times I heard him say it. When he said, "Here we are," I thought he was joking. Here looked like an empty brick factory. When he led me down a stinky alley, there was one second I wondered if I was doing something stupid. But I knew I wasn't, not with him. He opened a big metal door and I felt like Alice in Wonderland, but with chopsticks. The room was huge. It must have been a metal shop or some kind of factory. The machines were gone, but you could see the wear on the wood floors. It was full of people, mostly Chinese, sitting at long tables on benches, putting food on each other's plates and talking loud, louder than my own family, which is saying something. Aaron said there weren't any menus. You pointed to what was on the plate near you or let the waiter choose. But he'd been there before and ordered some Chinese dumplings, like kreplach, but much better. And two plates piled with chopped vegetables, meat, and rice. I couldn't believe how delicious it all was. Maybe it's something genetic, the Jewish-Chinese food thing. I asked Aaron if he knew what we were eating. "I don't know, but I'm sure it's not cat." "Cat?" He said there was a nasty rumor that the Chinese killed stray dogs and cats for meat. "It can't be true, because I've eaten a lot of Chinese food, and I never wanted to chase mice afterward." Aaron was getting more adorable by the minute, and the way he looked at me made me feel like I was floating. He started walking me back to my boarding house, but I didn't want the evening to end, so I said I knew where to get the best coffee in Boston if he wanted. Of course he wanted, so we went to Philomena's favorite cafe in the North End, which was another long walk. The waiter sat us in a back corner where it was dark and quiet, as if he knew we wanted to be alone. I asked Aaron if he liked his work. He said yes, but also no. They had made a big mistake by writing the law to apply to everyone under the age of 18, when all the state child labor laws were for 15 or 16-year-olds and younger. "But I won't give up yet. My parents think I should leave Washington, move back to Boston, go into my brother's law practice. It would be Metzke and Metzke until Rita passes the bar, and then we'll change it to Metzke, Metzke, and Metzke." He smacked himself on the forehead. If Rita were here, she'd tell me to shut up and let you talk. He took my hand and said, tell me something. By that time, I was so comfortable with your grandfather that I talked about my sisters. I told him they had been child laborers when they came to America, and that after listening to what the German doctor said about how mental problems could show up years later, I understood Celia in a different way. Aaron touched my cheek. He said the reason he'd gone to work for the Child Labor Committee was his mother, who had worked in a cotton mill as a little girl. There's a famous picture of a barefoot girl standing next to a big loom. Her eyes look old and hollow, the same as my mother's before she died. It was her lungs. The doctor said it was probably from the cotton dust. Aaron was 15 when he lost his mother. I was 16 when Celia died. Oh, Ava. There is so much sadness in this life. It was a Sunday night, and so quiet we could hear our own footsteps down Commonwealth Avenue. I didn't feel cold, but under the streetlights I could see Aaron's breath in the air, and I wondered if he was going to kiss me goodnight. There was no kiss, not then anyway. It turned out we were so late, my landlady had turned off the porch light. That meant the door was locked, and I didn't have a key. None of us did. It was the rule in a respectable house like Mrs. K's. No late nights. She could throw me out for this. I said maybe I can take the trolley to my sister's house in Roxbury. The train stopped running a while ago, said Aaron. But my cousin Ruth has her own place in the Fenway. I'm sure she'll let you stay over. He said it was a good thing we had drunk all that coffee to stay awake, but it also made me need to go to the bathroom. Not that I told him that. We did not take our time on that walk, let me tell you. A girl in a robe opened the door. What the hell's going on, Aaron? It's almost 1 o'clock in the morning. He explained what happened. Tell Addie I've never done this before. Ruth gave me the once-over and pinched Aaron's cheek. It's true. As far as I know, he's a straight shooter. I followed Ruth up to her flat, which smelled like cigarettes and spices. She gave me a nightgown, threw a blanket on the couch, and said goodnight. I thought I'd never fall asleep. I was gone the minute I closed my eyes. I guess falling in love makes you tired. Well, maybe it was all that walking. Ruth was still sleeping when I got up and tiptoed out of the apartment. The sun was just coming up, but Aaron was there, sitting on the steps with his suitcase. He hadn't shaved, and he was holding a bunch of daffodils he must have stolen from someone's yard. He said, God, you're beautiful. So I kissed him. Luck, I'm telling you. You know how people say that everything happens for a reason and that fate brings together people who are meant for each other? I don't buy that. Luck, on the other hand, I believe in. And it was pure luck that I met your grandfather. Aaron was living in Washington, and the only reason he happened to be at Miss Chevalier's house that Sunday afternoon was because Rita went into a coffee shop and ran into one of her law professors who was sitting with Miss Chevalier, who was interested to hear about her brother's work, and asked if he would be willing to speak to some friends. It so happened that he was going to be in Boston at the end of March for Passover. Luck. I'm telling you. The night after we met was the first Seder, so he was in Brookline with his family, and I was in Roxbury with mine. For most of the meal, my mother was in the kitchen telling Betty what she was doing wrong. My father had his face in the Haggadah, and Levine was trying to make his son sit still. I was thinking about Aaron and how we were planning to have breakfast before I went to work in the morning. But I must have been yawning a lot because Betty said that if I was so tired, I should sleep there. You can take the trolley to work from here in the morning. I said, no, so fast. She gave me a look like, what's going on? I made up a story about having to be at work earlier than usual and asked Levine if he would drive me home. I was out of there before Betty could ask me anything else. That week we were together as much as we could be. Thank God I didn't live at home, where I'd have to explain where I'd been and where I was going. Aaron told his parents that he had a lot of meetings at the State House, but he thought Rita probably suspected what was going on. We went to cafes and restaurants in out-of-the-way places. We took long walks and talked and kissed. The kissing was very nice. We were compatible that way, if you know what I mean. One night it rained, we went to a movie. We held hands the whole time and sat with our knees touching. I was glad we were in the dark so I could smile without having to explain why. When we walked past Symphony Hall, Aaron told me how his mother used to take him there when he was a boy. She wanted all of her children to love music. I said I wanted to go to a concert one day. I'd never been. I didn't mean it as a hint or anything, but he went inside and bought tickets for the next night. We got there early and watched the chauffeurs open limousine doors for the kinds of people who were always being mentioned in Serena's Out and About column. It was a sea of white hair and black coats, except for one woman wearing a green velvet cloak and waving at someone across the lobby with bright red nails. I grabbed Aaron's arm. "Do you see that woman? That's Tessa Thorndike. She's the other reason we met." Aaron asked if I wanted to say hello. I said she wouldn't know me from a hole in the wall. I hope we're not going to sit next to her. He laughed. "Don't worry." When it was time to go in, the swells like Tessa went downstairs, and Aaron and I headed to the balcony with the regular people. Students, shop girls, clerks. I even saw some laborers' hands on the banisters as we climbed the stairs. I heard people talking Yiddish, Italian, German, and French. Everyone seemed to be in a good mood. Our seats were in the last row of the highest balcony. Aaron held out his hands like he was handing me Symphony Hall on a platter, told me who the statues were and how many light bulbs were in the chandeliers. A man in a black suit walked out to the podium and stretched his arms wide like one of the black seabirds in Rockport that hold their wings out to dry in the breeze. Aaron whispered, "Koussevitzky." The music was different from anything I'd heard on the radio or from the piano at the movies. Some of the slow parts made me feel like crying. But when it got faster and the violinist was sawing away, my heart pounded like I was watching a horse race. I was listening, not just with my ears, but with my hands and my heart, too. I can't describe it. It's like trying to explain what chocolate tastes like. You just have to try it for yourself. When the music ended, I clapped until my hands hurt. Aaron said, "I'm glad you like Mozart, too." Taking me to the symphony turned out to be part of his plan to make me a real Boston girl. He said it was too chilly for a Red Sox game, but he took me to Harvard Yard and the Bunker Hill Monument. He even stayed in Boston an extra day for the opening of the Swan Boats at the Public Garden. We were on the very first boat of 1926. I took your mother and aunt to the opening day of the Swan Boats every year when they were girls, just like I took you and your sister when you were little. Aaron got the night train to Washington, and I went back to my room and cried myself to sleep. When I went to work the next morning, Catherine said I looked like death warmed over and sent me home. I knew I wasn't going to feel better in my dark little room, so I went to see Irene. She had married Joe Riley the year before, and they were living in a little apartment in the North End. They had met at work, where he was an electrician. It had taken him months to get her out on a date. She was off Irishman at the time. But he finally got her to agree by getting down on one knee and singing "Let Me Call You Sweetheart" in front of God and everyone. Irene admitted that he had a nice voice, but said, "I had to put a stop to it." She was 9 months pregnant at the time, so I knew I'd find her home. I told her about Aaron and started crying about how awful it was that he had to leave. But instead of holding my hand and telling me "there, there," she grinned. "It's about time you took a shine to a nice fella, and this one sounds grand. I like the sound of his name, too. If I have a boy, maybe I'll call him Aaron. Would you mind? That wasn't what I wanted to hear. I was blubbering.
But he's gone. He left me.
Irene crossed her arms. Didn't you just tell me he's coming back to see you next month? If you think he was lying, then you're better off without him, and good riddance. That set me off. Aaron was the most honest and decent man I'd ever met, and how could she say such a thing? Irene laughed. All right, then, she said. So let's talk about what I should cook when you bring him over to meet us. I'll try to make something that won't make us all sick. I could send him an invitation. Or maybe a warning would be better. I say so. I read Aaron's first letter 1,000 times. He made a list of everything he missed about me. My hazel eyes, my lovely hands, and my red shoes. He said to send him a list of novels he should read so he wouldn't feel stupid when I talked about books and writers he'd never heard of. As if he was stupid. A college man. A lawyer. We sent each other 2 or 3 letters a week. He wrote about what was going on at work and what it was like to live in Washington. I didn't have anything interesting to say about my job, so I introduced him to my friends. Gussie was making so much money, she bought herself a big house in Brookline and was renting rooms to Simmons girls who needed a cheap, decent place to live. Irene was so bored at home, she spent the whole day talking to her belly. When she ran out of things to say, she read out loud from the newspaper. She said the kid was going to come out of her wearing a Red Sox rosette. I wrote to Aaron about the postcards Philomena sent from New Mexico and Betty's love affair with her electric mixer and how my sister was already planning Jake's bar mitzvah, which wasn't for months. I started checking off days on the calendar until his visit, but then he wrote that the other lawyer in his office had quit, and unless someone else got hired, he might not be in Boston for another month or maybe more. He said he was sorry 3 or 4 times and that he felt terrible. He felt terrible. I was holding my breath until I saw him again, and now I didn't even know when that was going to happen. I started wondering if maybe Aaron wasn't so honest after all. Look how stupid I'd been about Harold and Ernie. What did I really know about him? Who knows, maybe he'd met someone in Washington. I wrote back, very polite, and said thank you for letting me know. I think I made some crack about how I hoped he'd enjoy the cherry blossoms and that I looked forward to his next letter. Well, Aaron got the message, and his next letter was 3 pages long about how much he missed me and how he hated being away from me and how bad he felt about keeping me waiting. He said he'd started working late every night and told his boss that he had to take a few days off to take care of some family business. He ended with a cute little P.S. I was glad that you ordered pancakes when we had breakfast together. Pancakes are the only things I know how to cook, and I will make them for you every day for the rest of your life, if you say so. I don't know how many times I read that P.S. before what he was saying sunk in. My letter back to him had only 3 words. I say so. Maybe a week later, when I got home from work, my landlady was waiting for me at the door. She waved a piece of paper in my face and blamed me for almost giving her a heart attack. In those days, the main reason people sent telegrams was to say that someone had died. I only opened it to see if I should get out smelling salts for you, she said. Some people waste money like it was water. Aaron's telegram said, "Tell Irene I will be there on Friday." The 4 of us had a great time at dinner. Irene cooked a delicious meal. For dessert, she went to the bakery and bought an apple pie. I said it was almost as good as Mrs. Morse's. "Oh, no," Irene said. "Once she gets started about those pies, there's no stopping her." "But I want to hear what Addie has to say about pie," Aaron said. Joe winked at me. "He's got it bad." Aaron said, "Guilty as charged." He had to go back to Washington on Sunday morning, so we really only had 1 day together. I wanted to go to Rockport, but it would have taken too long, so we got off the train at Nahant and walked on the beach for a couple of hours. We talked about where we might get married and how many children we wanted and decided not to tell our families until Aaron moved to Boston. His plan was to be back by the 4th of July or sooner if they could find someone to replace him. That was the day he gave me the gold locket I always wear. Inside it's engraved, March 29, 1926, the day we met. You know, if one of my daughters had told me she was going to marry a man she'd only known for a week, I would have locked her in her room. But we weren't kids. I was 25 and he was 29. We were completely sure. And obviously we were right. Aaron didn't tell his parents he was in town that weekend. Only Ruth knew. He slept on her couch Friday night, and Saturday night she stayed with a girlfriend so we could be alone. Just the two of us. For the whole night. I'll leave it at that. At least she didn't suffer. I was counting the days until the 4th of July and thinking about the best way to introduce Aaron to my family. When should I tell Betty, and would it be better to have her tell Mama that there would be company for a Friday dinner, or should I just have him come to the house on a Sunday afternoon? He wasn't writing as many letters, but I didn't mind. I knew he was working extra hours so he could leave his job, knowing he'd taken care of everything he could. Things were moving along nicely until the middle of June, when my landlady died in her sleep. At least she didn't suffer. That's what everyone said. In fact, that was all anyone said. Nobody disliked her. Actually, nobody knew anything about her, including boarders who had lived in her house for 10 years. She was a widow who didn't have children. That was it. It was the fastest funeral I've ever been to. The only people there were the boarders and two nephews. There wasn't even a eulogy. After the service, the nephews asked us to meet them in the parlor that afternoon. We all went. There wasn't a cup of coffee or a cookie anywhere, but it turned out that we weren't there for a shiver. It was a business meeting to tell us all that they were selling the building, and we had 10 days to get out. One of the old ladies fainted, and the rest of them looked like they might keel over, too. There weren't a lot of boarding houses left for women in Boston. Rents were high, and what could you find in a week anyway? Some of the women had relatives to turn to, but there were five who seemed to be completely alone in the world. They had probably planned to leave the boarding house the same way as the landlady, feet first. I could hear them crying in their rooms. My next-door neighbor stopped me in the hallway and begged me to help her. She said, "I don't have anyone else to ask." I had no idea how to help, but I figured that Miss Chevalier would. And by the time we had to move out, she'd gotten 5 beds at the YWCA on Berkeley Street. I was embarrassed at the way they kept thanking me. I told Miss Chevalier, "You're the one who saved the day. I didn't do anything." She said, "Of course they should thank me. You took pity on them and you knew whom to ask. That's more than half the battle, and you won it for them." It wasn't a hardship for me. Aaron and I were planning to get married in the fall, so I'd only have to put up with my family for a few months, and I can't say I was sorry to be leaving that dark, smelly house. On the day I moved out, I was sitting on the steps waiting for Levine to pick me up with his car. The idea of living under the same roof as my mother made me feel like I was 15 again. In other words, miserable. But then the mailman came and handed me a letter from Aaron. It was like one of those silly coincidences that only happen in novels. I kissed the envelope. I nearly kissed the mailman. I was on top of the world. Until I opened it. "Dear Addie, I hope you won't be too upset, but..." Aaron was on a train to Minnesota to see if he could help get the amendment passed in St. Paul. Only 4 states had ratified so far, and they badly needed a win. He said it would only be a few weeks, maybe a month. The rest of what he wrote was apologies. "Forgive me. I love you. We'll be together soon. I'm sorry. Don't be mad. I wasn't just mad. I was spitting nails mad. Hadn't he said it was a lost cause? Wasn't I more important than a lost cause? Who knew how long he'd really be gone and how long I'd be stuck in Roxbury with my mother breathing down my neck? I wrote him an angry letter and I tore it up. I wrote him a whiny, woe-is-me letter with tear stains all over it, and I tore that up too. In the end, I sent a postcard to the hotel where he was staying. Dear Mr. Metzke, please send mail for Miss A. Baum to Miss Henrietta Cavendish at the Boston Evening Transcript. It wasn't nice, but it could have been worse. Moving into the house in Roxbury felt like I'd gone backward in time. Betty was upstairs with her family, and I was on the first floor with my parents. It seemed as if nothing had changed, even though nothing was the same. The boys had changed the most. All of them were taller, smarter, and louder. My mother called them wild animals, wilde Geiers, and said Betty wasn't strict enough. But Jake, Eddie, Richie, and Carl were just healthy kids, got good grades, and did whatever their mother asked. They were always glad to see Auntie Addie when I visited, especially Eddie. But after I told them how big they were getting and after they told me what they were doing in school, we didn't have much to say to each other. I was like a friendly moon circling around their busy little planet. And even though he lived downstairs, my father was just as distant. I'm not sure he even knew which grandson was which. He never fell in love with any of them the way he had with Lenny, and he didn't see much of them since he was in the house only to eat and sleep. After Papa got laid off from his job, he did exactly what Levine had suggested and spent his days in the synagogue library with Avram and a bunch of old men. We called them Alta Cockers. Today they would be retirees. The rabbi studied with them sometimes, and one day he asked if Papa would be interested in teaching boys to get ready for their bar mitzvahs. The parents would even pay something for his trouble. I think that was my father's dream come true. He went to the barber and asked Betty to help him choose a new suit, because a man who teaches Torah can't go around looking like a peasant. He didn't act much different at home, but he held himself taller. You could almost say he was happy. Mama had changed the least. She cleaned and cooked and complained. She wouldn't touch Betty's washing machine. She said it ruined the clothes and didn't get them as clean as she got them with her washboard. And then she groaned about how doing the laundry was killing her back. She grew cabbages in the backyard, bitter and hard like baseballs. No one would eat them but Mama, who said they were at least fresh, and what did we know? My mother did go out of the house more since they moved to Roxbury. Maybe because there were no neighbors in the same building, or maybe it was because there were fewer cars. At first she did some of the shopping, but the greengrocer kicked her out of his store when she accused him of putting his thumb on the scale. She gave the butcher such a hard time about how much fat he left on the meat that he wouldn't let her in his shop either. Eventually, the only place Mama could go was the fish market, where she was friends with the owner's wife, who was as quiet as a fish herself. She had an unmarried nephew, and the two of them decided he was perfect for me. Mama said he was from a good family and he made a nice living. He's 39 years old and ready to settle down. Betty said, he's 200 pounds and not very smart. Leave Addie alone, Ma. With ankles like that, she's not such a catch herself, she said, as if I wasn't in the room. They still didn't know about Aaron. I wasn't worried about introducing him in person. A Jewish man with a good profession from a nice family, what's not to like? But until he was standing next to me, I didn't think I could have said his name out loud without crying like a baby. I have no choice, Addie. At least I still liked my job, which was never boring. Miss Flora announced that she was leaving to be the editor of the women's page of the Cincinnati Enquirer. I was stunned. I always thought she was as Bostonian as the statue of George Washington in the public garden, and just as permanent. If Flora had been a man, I'm sure Cornish would have understood why she'd want to run her own section. But he had said good riddance, and it just proved that women were fickle and didn't belong in the newsroom. The morning after she left, I found him passed out under his desk. When he sobered up, he told Catherine that she'd have to take over Flora's work in addition to her own. Catherine marched into Mort's office and said she would stay on only if she got a promotion and a raise and if I came on as her full-time assistant. Cornish called that uppity and thought she should be fired, but Mort gave her everything she asked for. I hadn't known much about Catherine or Flora. We didn't pal around after hours like the men did. Catherine was a hard worker, but Flora had been the bigger talker. Until she took over, I didn't know how much Catherine had on the ball. She told everyone to call her Miss Walters and to call me Miss Baum. "You and I can be familiar with each other," she said, "but why should they call us by our Christian names if we can't do the same to them? We're not their maids." She was right, but nobody in the newsroom was ever going to call me Miss Baum. When you start out somewhere as the girl, you never grow up. Catherine, Miss Walters, told me I would still be writing seen and heard, but she wanted more about the younger set, especially what they were wearing. She brought in a stack of Vogue magazines, and I learned a whole new language. Organza, peplum, bias cut, pinafore. All that reading made me take a new look at what Catherine was wearing. Maybe I hadn't noticed because she was always in black, but now I realized that she wore whatever was the latest silhouette, one of my new words, and that her drop-waist dresses were perfect for a woman of her height. No one would ever call Catherine Walters a pretty woman. Her face was strangely flat, and one eye was a tiny bit higher than the other. After Flora left, she took off her hat, cut her bangs, and was suddenly striking and stylish, which is actually much better than pretty. Catherine said I could also go back to writing about interesting lecture topics in Seen and Heard, but nothing as upsetting as that piece about the Negroes. She said there was a place for stories like that, but not on the women's pages. She suggested I look into the work of the Women's Educational and Industrial Union and the ladies who sat on the Symphony Board of Trustees. You'll enjoy that. I did, but I also had to write the how-to stories that had been Flora's specialty. How to lose weight, clean the icebox, make homemade hand lotion, set the table for an afternoon of bridge or mahjong, mend stockings so it didn't show. It wasn't hard, but it was a lot to learn about things that didn't interest me at all. Catherine kept everything running smoothly, so Cornish could go on as he did before, coming in late, reading the papers, joking with reporters, and leaving early. Catherine kept her distance from him, but she read him the riot act when she saw me delivering his morning coffee. "Miss Baum's new responsibilities are such that she no longer has time to act as your personal servant. Please remember that." He was too surprised or maybe too hungover to come up with a snappy comeback. But if looks could kill... Cornish didn't speak to her at all after that. If there was something he absolutely had to tell her, he dropped a crumpled-up note on her desk or sent a message through me. "Tell that blasted beanpole she's got to cut 10 inches today." I must have smiled at beanpole, which set him off making up funny names for Catherine. Miss Maypole, the giraffe, the Boston Colossus. He started announcing them loud enough so everyone in the newsroom could hear. The reporters got a kick out of this until the day he called her the monumental bitch. You could have heard a pin drop. It's not as if those guys didn't use that word and plenty worse. But there were rules about where and when you were supposed to say them. Catherine had been ignoring Cornish's game, but this time she said in the sweetest, most ladylike voice, "My goodness, Ian, do you kiss your mother with that mouth?" That got a big laugh, and the police reporter, who was as foul-mouthed as the rest of them, said, "Want me to get you a bar of soap to wash it out, Miss Walters?" Work became a minefield for me after that. Catherine said she would let me go if I did any more favors for that man. But the minute she stepped out of the room, Cornish would send me out for a magazine or a bottle of aspirin and threaten to fire me if I didn't do it. To make things even worse, the weather was miserably hot and muggy. The newsroom only had 3 windows facing the street. And when the sun hit them in the afternoon, I bet it was 90 degrees in there. There was 1 fan, no water cooler, and those men didn't shower every day. Aaron's letters became the bright spots in my life. They always started, "My dear Miss Cavendish, I hope this letter finds you and your staff in the best of health." The first one didn't mention my snippy postcard, which was big of him, but he didn't apologize for being so far away either. He wrote about the trip west and his assignment, which was to talk to any state legislator who seemed to be leaning in favor of the amendment. He said he had eaten the best pancakes he'd ever tasted in his St. Paul hotel and was going to bribe the cook to give him the recipe. He always ended his letters, "Sincerely and forever yours, A. Metzke." After a few weeks, his letters got to be less cheerful. It was as hot in St. Paul as it was in Boston. His hotel room was suffocating, most of the food was tasteless, and he felt invisible. Going to Minnesota in the summer had been a big mistake. The state legislature wasn't in session, and the representatives were back at their farms, which were all over the state. Aaron was riding milk trains to talk to possible supporters, but all he got was splinters on his backside from sitting on wooden crates and bites from mosquitoes he claimed were the size of bumblebees. He wired his boss to say that he might as well come back, but he was told to stay, find some stories about local child laborers, and get invited to speak at women's self-improvement societies and church auxiliaries. Aaron said that if you can move a roomful of mothers to tears, you could raise an army for a cause. There were plenty of stories. For 60 years, children had been sent to Minnesota on orphan trains. It was a well-intentioned idea, a way to give abandoned children a better life with wholesome farm families. Being out in the country had to be better than the misery of crowded orphanages, right? Some of those children must have been well taken care of and loved, but it wasn't hard finding kids who were not. Aaron struck up a conversation with a young man at a cafe who said he'd been put on the train from Baltimore when he was 12 and his younger brother Frank was 5. He remembered being lined up on a platform where the women would pick out little children with blue eyes and good teeth, like his brother, and the men chose bigger boys who could go to work right away. He was told to forget about his old family and start over, but he didn't forget his brother and tried running away to find him. He got a good hiding when he was caught. There were plenty of orphan train children still living with families that had taken them in, but it wasn't easy to talk to them. Aaron ran into a girl named Martha when he was getting off the train at a stop just outside St. Paul. She was unloading sacks of flour and sugar as if they were full of feathers, even though she wasn't any bigger than me. Martha was 16. She had been 8 when the nuns put her on a train and the Olsons took her in. She didn't pine for her family in New York. After her mother walked out, her father brought her to an orphanage. "He kept my brothers," she said. "He told them he didn't know what to do with a girl." When Aaron asked her if she was happy with her Minnesota family, Martha said the Olsons were not her family. They weren't as bad as some she knew about. They never hit her, and she got plenty to eat and new boots when the old ones wore out. She said they even sent for the doctor once when she was sick. But they made Martha stop going to school when she was 10, and they talked about her as the girl. "Tell the girl to pass the milk." He said they treated her like something between a prize farm animal and a daughter. Martha worked in the cookhouse, where she put out 3 meals a day for farmhands. In the winter, her hands bled from washing dishes. She had taken to sleeping with a knife under her pillow in case one of the workers got any ideas, but she was really afraid of her big brother who wouldn't leave her alone. Martha said that Mrs. Olson wouldn't believe anything bad about her son. Those were hard letters to read, but they were love letters, too. Aaron was showing me who he was, what was in his heart. The more I knew him, the more I loved him, and he opened my eyes to what was going on around me. I started to notice boys and girls who should have been in school selling newspapers, shining shoes, scrubbing stoops, and carrying baskets of laundry. It made me proud of what Aaron was doing. I couldn't leave his letters at home. My mother was always in my room, rehanging my clothes, rearranging my books, even refolding the clothes in my drawers. Once I asked if she was looking for something in my underwear. She said she didn't like a mess in her house and that I wouldn't care unless I had something to hide. I kept Aaron's letters in a big envelope under a stack of magazines in the bottom drawer of my desk at work. I was the first one in the newsroom every morning so I could get the mail for Miss Cavendish and check for new letters. Sometimes I pulled the drawer open just to see his handwriting. One day, when I opened the drawer, the envelope was gone. I made a beeline for Cornish's desk since he was the only one I could imagine who would want them. He could use them to get me in trouble or blackmail me into going out with him again. He might even burn them out of pure spite. Luckily, Catherine caught me before anyone else came in. "I've got them," she said. She had seen Cornish sniffing around my desk after I left. "He must have noticed the way you were always leaning over that drawer and sighing. I asked if I could help him find something. It's convenient that he still isn't talking to me." Catherine had taken the envelope home for safekeeping and told me to come to her apartment after work. "I'll fix dinner and you can tell me all about Mr. Metzke." She had a tiny apartment in the Fenway, not far from where Aaron's cousin Ruth lived. But Catherine's place was like a jewelry box inside. A dark red rug on the floor, bright-colored fabrics hanging on the walls, scarves hung over the lampshades. "It's mostly from Morocco," she said. "I got them on my honeymoon." I said I didn't know she was married. "Aren't you Miss Walters?" "I'm widowed. He died in the war." She was quiet for a moment. "I don't like talking about him to strangers." "You should always be kind to people, Ava. You never know what sorrows they're carrying around." It was a very exotic supper of things I'd never heard of. Hummus, pita bread, olives with pits, and a kind of chopped salad. Catherine was pretty exotic herself. A Buddhist, a socialist, and a feminist. She graduated from Smith College, was a vegetarian, and did yoga. She was planning to visit all 48 states and had been to 12 so far, including New Mexico. When I told her about Philomena and Taos, she said it was one of her favorite places. "You must see it, you and Aaron." Catherine apologized for reading the letters. "At first, I was just looking to see what Cornish was after, but I couldn't stop. It's been so long since I read anything so sincere or tender. You're a lucky girl. But poor Martha, what an awful story. Have you thought about writing about her?" Catherine had read my mind. Martha was like a heroine in one of the short stories they'd printed in women's magazines. A sad, brave girl in trouble, through no fault of her own. But when I said I was thinking of changing it to fiction, she said I should write it as a reporter. It will have more power that way. Lewis Hine changed a lot of minds with his photographs of factory girls. Martha's story might do the same thing. We talked about it for a long time. She said the local newspapers wouldn't print anything like it, but there were magazines that would. The next day I was in the library reading La Follette's, The Atlantic Monthly, and The Nation. I wrote to Aaron and asked what he thought about my telling Martha's story, but in a way she wouldn't be recognized. I can't tell you how relieved I was to get his okay, because I'd already read up on the orphan trains and written a first draft. I was totally consumed by Martha's story and the idea that I was helping Aaron to save children from mistreatment. I rewrote that story I don't know how many times before I let Catherine see it. She said, "Well done," and made me rewrite it 2 more times before she said it was ready. She let me keep my original title, though, The Human Face of the 20th Amendment. I took it to the Atlantic Monthly magazine first, because why not start at the top? And also the office was in Boston. The girl at the front desk was very stuck up. "We don't publish pieces by unknowns," she said. After all the work I'd done, I wanted to say, "Who the hell do you think you are?" But I was polite. I told her what my article was about and how it put a face on child labor, and I hadn't seen anything like it anywhere else. It pays to be nice. She took the story and said her mother started working when she was 11 years old. She still gets sad when she talks about leaving school. I'll put it on the editor's desk myself. When I went back a week later, the same girl handed it back to me. She said she was sorry. "I told you, they don't publish unknowns." Catherine said rejection was part of the business and to try The Nation, where she knew one of the editors. It was published 2 weeks later. I opened and closed that magazine over and over for the thrill of seeing my name on that page. By Addie Baum. I'd never been prouder of anything. I sent a copy to Aaron, special delivery, no less. Irene and Joe were very impressed and asked what I was going to write next. Gussie bought a dozen copies and said she always knew I had it in me. Catherine took me out for dinner to celebrate, and Miss Chevalier called to ask if I would speak at one of her Sunday afternoon gatherings. I seem to remember that you can be very effective in front of an audience. I wanted to show it to my family. Betty would have made a huge fuss and told everyone in the neighborhood and all of her clubs and organizations. Even my parents might have been impressed. Maybe, but since I didn't know how to explain how I knew about Martha without mentioning Aaron, I decided to wait. I was walking on air all week, and I guess I didn't hide my feelings very well because Betty asked if I'd met someone. Eddie told me I looked pretty, and my mother said, "Since when do you whistle?" I was in such a fog that when Mort said he wanted to talk to me in his office, I thought he was going to give me a raise. But when he pointed at the chair across from his desk, I knew I was in trouble. Sitting down in there was never a good sign. Mort's face was usually easy to read, but not that time. He said Cornish had seen my story in The Nation and sent it to the owner of the Transcript. "What were you thinking, Addie?" Mort said. "You must have read the paper's editorials against the amendment, a plot against states' rights and the sanctity of the family and all that. This was like spitting in the owner's eye. I was upstairs all afternoon getting my ass handed to me." I told him I never meant to get anyone in trouble, especially him. "I'll be all right, but it took some doing to talk him out of firing Catherine Walters. I told him she didn't know a thing about it, and I never want to know otherwise, you understand?" I apologized. I asked if there was anything I could do. Would it help if I wrote the owner and told him it was completely my fault? Mort shook his head. "Why the hell did you have to use your own name? If you'd signed it Sally Smith, you could have made your point, and we wouldn't be sitting here. I thought you were smarter than that." He looked like his dog had just died. "I have no choice, Addie. I have to let you go." This is Auntie Addie's fella. I didn't tell them at home I'd been fired. Betty would push for the details, and Levine would tell me to come to work for him again. Most of all, I didn't want to see the "I'm not surprised" look on my mother's face. The next morning, I left the house at the usual time, as if it were a regular work day. First, I went to the telegraph office to let Aaron know not to send any more letters to the newspaper, Then I went to see Gussie about her offer to help me get another job. It was so early, her office was still locked. I leaned against the wall in the hallway to wait, and I guess I closed my eyes because the next thing I knew, she was next to me. Addie, what's wrong? Did somebody die? Gussie asked me if I wanted an aspirin or a cup of tea. I kept telling her I was okay, but she said she was getting me a glass of water, which was good because it gave me a minute to take in the decor. Did I already tell you about how Gussie dressed? Boxy suits, flat shoes, no lipstick. But her office looked like the powder room at the Ritz. There were embroidered pillows on all the chairs and pictures of flowers on the walls. Even the lampshade on her desk was pink. It was hard to keep a straight face when she came back and asked what was going on. This being Gussie, it turned into a real cross-examination. She was up to date about the story I'd written, but I hadn't said much about Aaron other than how we'd met and that we were writing letters to each other. Since Gussie saw Betty at Hadassah meetings, I didn't want her spilling the beans before I did. It's not that Gussie was a gossip, but sometimes she got excited. When I finished telling her the whole story, she let me have it. Her feelings were hurt. She was mad that I didn't trust her. What did I think friends were for, anyway? And then, before I could say I was sorry, she asked if I wanted to start working right away for a lawyer down the hall. One of his secretaries had sprained her wrist, and he was in a jam. That was Gussie in a nutshell, full of herself and ready to give you the shirt off her back. I started working for the lawyer that morning, and even though typing contracts and letters were not nearly as interesting as newspaper work, I made a lot more money for fewer hours than I had at the transcript. There was a phone on my desk at the lawyer's, and Gussie called every few hours to see how I was doing and to tell me what she was up to. She had done the same thing when I was at the newspaper until I said I'd get fired if she didn't stop. Gussie loved the telephone like nobody else. She had one at home as well as in her office, and whenever a new model came out, she bought it. She said everyone was going to have a telephone sooner or later, but not soon enough for her. Betty and Levine had a phone at home, too, though I think they only used it to talk to each other during the day. Nobody ever called at night, so when Betty came downstairs and said there was a call for me, I knew it had to be Gussie. She didn't call to tell me about an idea she had had or to ask if I wanted to have lunch with her tomorrow. She had a message from Catherine Walters, who wanted me to go to her apartment after work the next day. Before she hung up, Gussie said, "And afterwards, you are going to tell me everything she says." I was praying that Catherine had a letter from Aaron, and when she opened the door with an envelope in her hand, I did a little dance. "You'll notice I didn't open it," she said, "but I was tempted." Aaron was on his way home. He had to stop in Washington to pack, but he would be in Boston as soon as possible. 2 weeks tops. The letter was postmarked almost a week earlier, which meant he could be home any moment. It also meant he left before he got my wire about being fired. I let Catherine read the letter. She said she couldn't wait to meet him and had some other news for me. "I didn't want you hearing it from anyone but me." Cornish had caught her in the mailroom with Aaron's letter to Miss Cavendish. When he told me to hand it over, I stuffed it down the front of my dress, wished him a lovely day, and quit. I was horrified. "I made you lose your job?" Catherine said I had nothing to do with it. It was just a matter of time before he fired me, and I was more than ready to go. She said that helping me with the child labor story had made it hard for her to keep writing about hats and hairdos. "Especially with everything going on these days, I need to do something important. The Sacco Vanzetti Defense Committee needs a person who doesn't sound like a maniac to talk to the newspapers. Someone like me." Even though Catherine kept saying she was glad to leave the transcript, I felt responsible, and going to the Sacco Vanzetti group could be dangerous. They had just lost an appeal for a new trial, and there had been a bombing. Some of the hotheads were talking like bombs were a good thing. I did a lot of worrying after that. How was Catherine going to manage? What if the child labor people roped Aaron into staying in Washington again? What if Aaron was hit by a car? I was sitting in my room driving myself crazy when Betty came downstairs and said there was another telephone call for me. If this keeps up, you're going to have to start paying me to be your secretary. But when I got there, the phone was on the hook. Betty yelled, "Herman, I'm back." He yelled back, "I'm coming." But it was Aaron who walked in. First, I was speechless. Then I said, "Why are you here?" He laughed. "Why do you think?" I started crying and we held each other until I pulled away and looked at him. "It really is you." Then he got all teary-eyed and I laughed. Levine and Betty and the boys watched our big reunion, and Eddie said, "Is Auntie Addie sad or happy?" Betty said, "She's very happy. This is Auntie Addie's fella." Aaron put his arm around my shoulder and made it official. "If it's okay with you, I'd like to be her husband." Betty shrieked and grabbed me. Levine shook Aaron's hand and poured the last drops out of a secret bottle of whiskey. Prohibition wasn't over yet. He lifted his glass. "Mazel tov, and may you be as happy together as me and my bride." What's his name? Betty thought the whole thing with Aaron was so romantic, she wasn't mad that I hadn't told her sooner. And she decided a Friday night supper at her place was the best place to introduce him to our parents. She told Mama that Levine was bringing a young man, the brother of someone he knew from business. "A lawyer," Betty said. "Herman thinks he's a catch." Just as those words were coming out of her mouth, Eddie walked into the kitchen and said, "Are you talking about Uncle Aaron? He promised to play stickball next time he's here." If Betty had been the kind of mother who smacked her kids, he would have gotten it. But she changed the subject and just told him to go outside. My mother was not going to ignore the fact that we had been sneaking around behind her back. So Aaron started with one strike against him. It wasn't so easy with Papa either, not after he heard that Aaron's family belonged to Temple Israel. "That's a church, not a shul. I wouldn't step a foot in that place." "You already did," I said. "It's where Betty got married." "Once was enough." Jake was the one who softened Papa up a little. My father was tutoring him for his bar mitzvah, which was probably the first time the two of them spent more than a minute together. Papa said Jake was smart and a serious student, and Jake started calling him Rav Baum. So when Jake said Aaron was a good guy, it counted for something. I wasn't looking forward to that dinner. I was going to marry Aaron no matter what my parents said, but I didn't want them to hate him. I was probably more worried what he would think of them. You never marry just one person. You get the whole family as part of the deal. As soon as Aaron arrived, Betty made us go right to the table. No chit-chat. She lit candles and Papa made kiddush with one eye on Aaron to see if he knew when to join in. He did. After we passed around the challah and they schmoozed a little, he told Aaron that he spoke a good Yiddish. But Mama looked at him like he was a sick cow someone was trying to trick her into buying. She shook her head when she saw him pick up his spoon with his left hand and winced when he unfolded his napkin and put it on his lap. To her, left-handed people were dishonest or unlucky or both, and doing anything but wiping your mouth with a napkin was putting on airs. She even smirked at his bow tie, which he had bought to make a good impression. Betty did her best to build him up. "Papa, did you know that Aaron's first cousin is a big doctor at Beth Israel Hospital?" Levine said, "And his brother is a very successful attorney." Mama pretended she hadn't heard any of that and asked Betty, "Was ist sein Name? What's his name? Where does he work?" As if Aaron hadn't been talking in Yiddish to Papa since he got there. Levine said, Michael Metzke is one of the biggest real estate lawyers in town. Very successful. We've had dealings with him. Mama shrugged. That's the brother. Aaron laughed, but I wanted to scream. Wasn't her whole purpose in life to get me married to someone exactly like him? I went to the kitchen to make coffee and calm down. When I got back, Aaron was on the floor playing tiddlywinks with the boys. Betty said, look how good he is with children. He'll be a wonderful father. To no one in particular, my mother said, they all think I'm stupid. From as long as I could remember, Mama talked to herself under her breath. She muttered spells to ward off the evil eye and kvetched about how Betty never made the tea hot enough. But her hearing wasn't as good as it used to be, so she didn't whisper anymore, and that time you could have heard her from the other room. He didn't eat a thing. What's the matter with him? Her meat was a little dry, but nobody makes better carrots than me. When you visit someone, you eat. Betty tried to shush her, but Mama didn't notice. She turns up her nose at a man who owns a store. This one doesn't even have a job. Eddie said, Bubby, why are you talking to the salt shaker? That seemed to wake her up. She said, come eat your compote. Aaron said, Mrs. Baum, my father owns a hardware store and I worked there when I was growing up. But Pop wanted us to go to college. I think he was hoping for doctors or maybe pharmacists, but he says he's proud of his lawyers anyway. Betty said, Aaron's sister is going to law school, too. A lawyer is not a job for a woman, Mama snapped. Then she pointed at Aaron and said, young man, eat the fruit at least. I walked Aaron outside and made excuses for the meat. It really was dry. And for my mother. But he thought it all went well. Your father was nice to me. Betty and your brother-in-law are in our corner, and the boys are terrific. 8 out of 9 ain't bad. And maybe if I clean my plate next time, your mother will come around, too. Aaron never gave up on people. Sometimes it drove me crazy, but it's a good way to live. The next Saturday, we were all invited to Aaron's family for supper. Betty promised that Mama would behave. She was probably nervous about meeting him, and anyway, everyone is more polite in someone else's house. We squeezed into Levine's car to get to Brookline. You remember that house, don't you, around the corner from where JFK was born? The front yard at the Metzkes was like nothing else on the street. There was no grass, just flower beds and roses climbing up the porch like the ones at Rockport Lodge. The flowers were Mildred Metzke's doing. She was Aaron's stepmother, and the opposite of evil stepmothers in the fairy tales. Murray Metzke married her 5 years after Aaron's mother died, and the three kids were as devoted to Mom as she was to them. She opened the door and hugged us like we were long-lost cousins. The Metzkes were all big huggers. Aaron, his father, and his sister Rita, even his brother Michael, who was kind of stiff, put his arms around each of us. My mother looked like she was being licked by cats, and she hated cats. When we sat down to eat dinner, which they didn't call supper, Mama asked the name of the kosher butcher where Mildred Metzke had bought the meat. She'd never heard of the place, leaned over to Papa and whispered in a voice that everyone could hear, it smells funny, no? Aaron said, that's rosemary, Mrs. Baum. Mom grows all kinds of herbs in the backyard. Mama said, so, herbs and flowers. Me, I grow cabbages and potatoes, things you can eat. Thank God Mildred didn't understand a lot of Yiddish. Rita and Mildred gushed over the boys, which was all Betty ever wanted to hear. Levine and Michael figured out they knew a lot of the same people. Murray and my father went outside and smoked cigars. Aaron and I held hands under the table. When Mildred put out coffee and cake, Murray stood up and made a speech about how happy they were that Aaron had found me. When he went off to Washington, I was afraid he'd find a girl from there and never come back. When he went to Minnesota, I worried he'd meet a girl there and she wouldn't want to leave her family. He said they liked me not only because I was a Boston girl, but also because Aaron was so happy, and I was so lovely, and my father was a chacham, a scholar, and the boys were extraordinary. Murray shook his finger at me and gave me one of those naughty, naughty looks. These boys only need some cousins to play with. I swore I would never embarrass my own children like that, and I never did, at least not in public. When it was time to go, the Metzkes started again with the hugging, which took a while because everyone had to hug everyone else. It was as if they thought we might crash into an iceberg and disappear on the way back to Roxbury. My mother hated all that grabbing. When we were back in the car, she said, "It feels like they're trying to pick my pocket." It was strange for me, too, but I got used to it. Remember when I used to chase you and your sister around the house to get my daily minimum requirement of hugs? I said if I didn't get 100 hugs, I would float up into the sky like Mary Poppins and you would never see me again. We stopped playing that game when you started school, but we never stopped hugging.